From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, who are the refugees coming to our country?
We resettle very vulnerable refugees. In fact, over the last 10 years, 60% of the refugees resettled in the United States are women and children.
You'll meet a young Syrian family settling into their new life in Michigan.
We look at America as this great country with freedom, with rights, with prosperous futures for work, with education for children. Those are the things that are really important to us.
A Great Lakes advocate on giving water to Waukesha.
I am not worried that this is going to end up being death by a thousand straws into the Great Lakes.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. More Syrian refugees have come to Michigan seeking a new life than any other state. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we will meet a young family who fled the violence in their homeland of Syria for a new life in Dearborn.
Yes, we are refugees, and you maybe have a fear of us because you don't know us, just as we have a fear when we arrived here because we didn't know what to expect.
One family's journey to America. Also in the hour, we'll get the State Department's take on Michigan's role in the nation's refugee resettlement program. But first,
we have a mighty stick, and we're here on behalf of the state of Michigan and the citizens of Flint.
That's Special Assistant Attorney General Todd Flood, who's leading Attorney General Bill Schuette's criminal investigation into the Flint water crisis. That investigation has now led to a civil lawsuit being filed today against water engineering companies involved in trying to fix the city's water problems. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta was at this morning's announcement in Flint and is with us now. Rick, who's being sued?
Well, there are several entities that are being sued, but the primary targets are two corporations, Veolia and LAN, and these are big water engineering firms. Veolia is a North American corporation, but its actual parent company is based in France, and LAN is a Houston-based company. And they were brought in not specifically to deal with the lead crisis, but to deal with other complaints that people were making about the water as far as the smell and the taste and the color and things like that. Yeah. But what this lawsuit says, filed by Todd Flood on behalf of Attorney General Bill Schuette, and what it says is, yeah, but you made big promises. You promised that you were going to do an end-to-end review of the system, that you were going to look at everything, and the upshot was that you didn't find, you didn't fix, and in fact, your actions exacerbated the lead water crisis that led to children being exposed and all the problems that went with that.
So this takes us back to those early weeks after the switch was made to Flint water when
right.
citizens were showing up with discolored water, stinky water, and filing complaints. And I remember water was treated later in that year, and that only made it worse.
Well, a key element, and this is what Bill Schuette said, a key moment was when General Motors announced that it was not going to use water from the Flint River. And he says that should have been a warning bell to these water professionals that there was a problem that they should have followed up on and didn't. Now, we should point out the water companies have wasted no time, that they've released statements, and it's not the, you know, the typically the sort of sterile, you know, we are not going to issue a comment because this is a matter of pending litigation.
What are they saying?
They are saying, no way, this is unwarranted. We didn't do it. That we complied with the terms of the contract and the lead and copper rule, the federal lead and copper rule, which is central to whether or, you know, to what happened in Flint, whether or not EPA rules were complied with. That was not part of our purview, not something that we were supposed to do. And one of the companies said, and we even advised you that you needed to be putting corrosion controls into the water, and you ignored it. And then they go back to all the previous reports that say, you know, that the Flint water crisis was caused by government officials not doing their jobs, not these private companies that were brought in as consultants.
So this was a robust reaction.
Very.
So this is going to be interesting as this plays out. And we should just be clear again, this is a civil lawsuit. This is not
right.
like the criminal charges that the AG filed in April against the two DEQ water regulators.
Right. And they say that investigation is continuing, and we can expect more criminal charges to be filed. And really the purpose of this is to go and recoup the state's costs in dealing with the Flint water crisis, and Schuette and Flood say we could be talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that could perhaps be put into a trust fund to be dealing with the ongoing effects of the water contamination in Flint for years and decades to come.
This is really it is fascinating watching this play out as things shift to courtrooms. Mm-hmm. What kind of timetable are we looking at?
This could take years. In all likelihood, will take years before it's all resolved and settled, unless they come to some settlement before then.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. As always, a pleasure, Rick.
It's a pleasure, Cindy.
The governors of the 8 states surrounding the Great Lakes have said yes to Waukesha. The Wisconsin city will be allowed to draw up to 8.2 million gallons of water from Lake Michigan each day. Waukesha's groundwater source is depleted and it's become contaminated with radium. This is the first big test of the Great Lakes Compact, which was formed 8 years ago to protect the water from being diverted by thirsty cities and states outside of the basin. Molly Flanagan is the vice president of policy for the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Molly, does the Alliance support this decision?
So we feel like the Compact Council and the regional body, so the Great Lakes governors and premiers, placed enough conditions on Waukesha's diversion proposal, so enough hoops that they have to jump through in order to get water. It sets a pretty high bar for future communities that might look at the Great Lakes as a source of drinking water.
Tell us, how was Waukesha's request amended to the point you can feel you can support it?
The proposal was amended in a number of ways, and I'm going to hit on three of the big ones, but there were numerous smaller amendments that were made as well. First, the area that Waukesha can provide water to was substantially reduced. In the beginning, you had a water service area that included not only the city of Waukesha, but parts of other surrounding communities. And we felt very strongly that it did not meet the definition of community under the Great Lakes Compact, and also that those communities had not made a case for why they needed Great Lakes water. And in fact, some of them were on record saying specifically that they did not need water and didn't want it. The Compact Council and regional body heard us loud and clear on that point and substantially shrunk the service area to only the city of Waukesha and some pieces of the town of Waukesha that are entirely surrounded by the city and have water supply lines next to their property.
Okay, that's point one.
Point one. The second change is, because of that reduced service area, the amount of water that Waukesha is allowed to withdraw each day was also substantially reduced and brought down from more than 10 million gallons per day to the 8.2 million gallons per day that they're now allowed to take from the Great Lakes. And then the third point is enforcement. There have been some significant concerns brought up that the state of Wisconsin, because of a variety of state laws and some opinions from the attorney general there, might not be able to make sure that all of the conditions that the Compact Council put on the diversion, that all of those are actually applied to the diversion. So the Alliance for the Great Lakes and a number of other organizations around the region said, that's a no-go. You know, this is federal law. You can't have an approved diversion that was only approved because of these significant conditions placed on it, then the state of Wisconsin or the city of Waukesha decide to ignore. There was some specific language added to make it really clear that all of the conditions have to be met, and that if they are not met, the Compact Council or individual states or individual organizations like the Alliance for the Great Lakes can take action in court to compel compliance with all of those conditions.
Because I know one of the key parts of the agreement now is that Waukesha can draw up to that 8.2 million gallons of water, but they have to treat and return an equal amount of water to the lake. People are concerned, will the rules be followed?
Yeah, so that's a really important point and a requirement under the Great Lakes Compact. Cities like Waukesha, if you get a diversion of water, then you have to send that water back to the Great Lakes. And absolutely, that is something that the Alliance for the Great Lakes and others will be watching really closely to make sure that not only the city of Waukesha is returning the right amount of water, but that the quality of that water that is returned is not causing harm to the Root River or to Lake Michigan.
Molly, what states proposed the amendments?
amendments were proposed by a number of states, but really Michigan, Minnesota, and the state of New York were leaders in offering amendments and negotiating those amendments among their colleagues in the other Great Lakes states and provinces.
Do you get a sense that Minnesota really does seem to be leading the way as the state that is most concerned in conserving Great Lakes water?
Minnesota has really been viewed as a leader in these discussions because it abstained from voting when the regional body voted. The other seven Great Lakes states voted to send the Declaration of Finding, which is essentially the document that the regional body put together that includes all of the conditions they wanted to place on Waukesha's proposal, onto the Compact Council. Minnesota did not vote. And so what that did was introduce some uncertainty about Minnesota's position and gave us some really good leverage to negotiate for some additional changes at the Compact Council level.
Now, there are people who are worrying that this decision opens the door to more outsiders who want to divert water from the Great Lakes. Are you one of them?
I am not worried that this is going to end up being death by a thousand straws into the Great Lakes. If you look at what Waukesha had to do in order to get to the vote that the Compact Council made approving this diversion, they spent more than 5 years working on this proposal. They spent millions of dollars preparing this proposal. That's all before they've actually paid for any infrastructure. A really long time period, a pretty arduous process. I think other communities that might have been eyeing the Great Lakes as a source of water are going to think really hard about whether that's the avenue they want to pursue, given all of the hoops that Waukesha is being forced to jump through.
Molly Flanagan, do you feel as though the Great Lakes Compact worked the way it was designed to?
The Compact Council and regional body really heard what citizens around the Great Lakes were saying in terms of their opposition and concerns about Waukesha's diversion proposal. The Great Lakes Compact was written to allow some of these limited exceptions. So broadly speaking, diversions of water to places like California are prohibited under the Great Lakes Compact. But diversions to communities very close to the Great Lakes region and these counties that straddle the Great Lakes Basin Divide are allowed to apply for a diversion if they have a problem with their drinking water source, which Waukesha has in terms of the radium contamination that you mentioned. You know, I think the Compact Council and regional body took a really hard and thoughtful approach to this and set a high bar for future communities that might want a diversion of Great Lakes water.
Molly Flanagan is the Vice President of Policy for the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Molly, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Up next, the challenge of school funding in Detroit and what's at stake for the kids. Then in 10 minutes, a film following the lives of Native Americans in Michigan fighting to keep their culture and traditions alive. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Yesterday, Governor Snyder signed the package of legislation designed to help Detroit public schools avoid bankruptcy and rebuild. But for the city's children, the legislation's long-term success is far from certain. A newly released study from the nonpartisan Citizens Research Council of Michigan points to a growing challenge in funding the education of Detroit's kids, something the GOP legislators who mainly crafted the new plan did not take into account. Craig Thiel is with the Citizens Research Council, and he is with us now. Craig, the new report is titled Public School Enrollment Trends in Detroit. What'd you find?
Well, what we know now with the most recent data is that Detroit Public Schools is no longer the majority educator of Detroit children. That responsibility belongs to charter schools both inside the city as well as outside the city. So basically schools that are drawing Detroit students, residents, to their schools for the K-12 education experience.
As I look at the report and I see these numbers, that the fact is that the Detroit public schools are teaching just 41% of all Detroit kids enrolled in public schools, down from 60%, and that's just 6 years ago. And you can pretty much see a nearly equal increase in the market share of the students in the charter schools, as you say, located inside and outside the city. 46% share. So parents are voting, aren't they?
Yes, parents are voting. The other important point is that the education market in Detroit continues to shrink. There was about 144,000 resident K-12 students enrolled in some type of public education in 2009, and that number is only at 110,000 students for this most recent current school year. So What that tells us is that the market's shrinking, the number of actors in that market, participants, is growing. So the math is inescapable in a sense that, you know, DPS and other school districts are seeing declining enrollment.
But your study found a noticeable increase in one group of students, and that's the number of special ed students in Detroit's public schools. Why is that?
I think the data suggests that the students that are leaving are the general ed students, and the students that are staying in DPS are the special ed students. And our study doesn't try to parse out the reasons. Mm-hmm. It's just we're just reflecting the numbers. When we looked at the market share of special ed students in Detroit and where they're going, what we found is that DPS is still the majority educator of those students. About 54% of the Detroit school children, residents in Detroit with special needs, are attending DPS, and only 46% are attending schools outside of DPS. So that includes charters and other traditional districts, as well as the Education Achievement Authority. So the school choice policies of the state, the families that are taking advantage of that are primarily the general ed students.
So Detroit Public Schools having a higher number of special ed students, do they have the staff, the resources to meet those needs?
Well, special ed's a little different beast than the general ed picture, and I think it's important for your listeners to realize this. Both federal and state mandates require services be provided to children with disabilities, and that those services are mandated by federal and state law, regardless of the costs associated with those. So students with disabilities are guaranteed services. This is a little different than in the K-12 setting where, you know, the dollars kind of constrain what services are available. So for DPS, 18% of the student body is eligible for special ed services of some amount. And if
so, that's nearly one of every five.
One out of every five is guaranteed these services. Statewide, that number is about 13%. So just to give your listeners a sense of scale, at least on the statewide basis. And with those mandated services, if the resources aren't there to provide them, then the special ed program has to borrow money, or not borrow money, actually takes money from the general ed setting to make sure that the services are provided. And we talk about that in our report a little bit. We came to the conclusion that about $1,000 per general ed student is going to subsidize special ed services in the Detroit Public Schools.
Which will mean what, ultimately, especially within the framework of the new bailout package?
Well, it means that a structural challenge that DPS has faced for a number of years will continue, because this bailout package doesn't deal with that in any direct sense. That general fund subsidy that has to go to support the special ed services will remain on DPS's books. The only way to manage that, obviously, is to either increase your general ed setting, the students in the general ed classroom, which would then kind of dilute a little bit the special ed population and really spread out that subsidy across a larger base.
Do you have a sense that the bailout package will help with that problem, maybe at least put the brakes on declining enrollment, if not actually maybe seeing an increase?
There's no doubt that the bailout package is going to relieve some of the financial pressures the district's facing currently in the short term and in the near term. You know, the district was spending close to $1,100 per student just servicing debts of years ago, and those debts will be washed away. It does give the district a fresh start financially. What our report suggests is that, you know, this issue of a shrinking Detroit market in terms of public education and the number of students, as well as DPS's declining market share, are going to be ongoing structural problems that, you know, there was an attempt in earlier versions of the reform package to deal with that through a Detroit Education Commission, but that was left on the cutting room floor in the final version of the bill. And so those structural aspects are going to continue over the midterm and long term to affect DPS's enrollment and ultimately its finances.
Is there any recommendation in terms of changing the way the state funds special ed, this idea of the funder of last resort?
First of all, we have to acknowledge that, you know, these are mandated services. These students require these services. and that the federal and state law probably aren't going to change to do that. So given that structure, the resources that are required to provide those services should be adequate and sufficient. Right now, the general fund, as we point out in the report, is responsible for picking up a large share of these resources. So that means the state would either have to step up to the plate and provide additional resources to fund special ed, or local communities need to have the authority to raise additional resources to pay for those services. Their hands are tied in terms of the amount of property tax that they can levy for special ed. And so policymakers would want to look at, you know, what those tax limits are and maybe adjust them so the appropriate amount of resources could be provided for special ed. And then I think a larger recommendation would be, you know, the Proposal A model doesn't attempt to differentiate the costs of educating students. The per pupil grant is not tied to the cost of educating students, whether they're special ed or students with language barriers. And our recommendation would be to look at the per pupil grant and try to align that with the actual costs associated with educating a specific child.
And how likely is it, do you think, that this legislature is willing to entertain any of these ideas?
Well, we're hopeful. There's signs that the legislature is interested in looking at school finance. They required an adequacy study as part of the road package last session. That has not been released yet, but it suggests that, you know, there is some interest in finding out what some of the major cross drivers are in education and where Michigan stacks up. I'm hopeful, but these are larger issues that go beyond just the DPS reform legislation that the legislature dealt with here recently.
And for those of you who want to check out this report and read it for yourselves, the public school enrollment trends in Detroit, you'll find it at the Citizens Research Council of Michigan website, crmich.org. Craig Thiel, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
When the people came from Europe, there were 100 million Native Americans in North and South America, and today there's a handful. I mean, it was an American Holocaust.
Our people make up less than 2% of the total United States population. It's very easy to become invisible in this country.
That's from a powerful documentary film, Our Fires Still Burn, The Native American Experience. The film follows the lives of Native Americans here in Michigan, fighting to keep their culture and traditions alive for us here today and for future generations. One of the producers of the film is with us now. Levi Rickert is an internet journalist and editor with Native News Online. He's editor-in-chief of the Tribal Business Journal and a member of the Prairie Band of the Potawatomi Nation. Levi, what story are you telling us in this film?
Well, I think one of the situations that Native people face all over the United States, and certainly here in Michigan, you know, with we being about 1%, maybe in some cases less than 1% of the population, many times non-Native people will say, well, we didn't even know American Indians still existed, as if we had fallen off the timeline back in, let's say, 1900. So I think Our Fire Still Burns really speaks to the fact that we still have presence. Certainly those who frequent Indian casinos understand that there are Native people here in Michigan. But by and large, it's let people know we still exist, and our fire still burns very strongly, actually.
And it also, as I can tell from what I've seen of it, it is a strong call to keep the culture alive for the young members of your tribes.
Yes, and I think that's really important. I know when I was a young child, there wasn't many powwows as there are right now. There's been in my lifetime a real resurgence of American Indian culture, and I think that's pretty significant. With the advent of the American Indian movement back in the 70s, and even here in the state, some of the tribes have gained their federal recognition. You know, I really think it really solidifies who we are as Native people, and it really allows us to be who we are. But there again, as you said, Cynthia, it's really important that the young people learn their culture, learn their language. When I was a little kid, it was not emphasized. It was basically go out there, get a good education, come back to us if we need to take care of you. I'm talking maybe our family. It's kind of the onset way they did business. But now it is, we are able to celebrate our culture, our language again. I think that's very significant.
Levi, the film Our Fires Still Burn, are you focusing on tribes in the Midwest?
Primarily, yes. Every tribe, basically, that was featured was here in Michigan. I know the Hannibal tribe up in Wilson, Michigan, and the Saginaw Chippewa tribe up in Mount Pleasant. The people of the three fires, and that would be the Ojibwa, Odawa, and Potawatomi, you know, we have been here for centuries. So it's, I think it really was really made to feature Michigan Indians. However, this film was picked up by PBS, and I've actually, through my Native News Online, I've actually had people email me to my Native News Online account and say, hey, I saw you on TV in San Francisco last night. And so it was kind of exciting. I think it was really nice.
Levi, let's talk about history for a little bit. Did tribes here in Michigan face different historical traumas from, say, let's say tribes in the Great Plains or the West and the Southwest? And I'm wondering how that Michigan history presents special challenges to keeping Native culture alive in this state.
That's a real interesting question, because I was asked that after I spoke one time years ago, and someone asked me, did American Indians, the tribes in Michigan, fare better than some of the others? And, you know, the answer to that really is, quite frankly, yes, in that some tribes were eliminated from the face of the earth. So we actually survived, and I think we know that as Native people. However, one of the things that is featured in the film, and that is a real recurring situation, something we deal with on an ongoing basis, is the boarding school experience. There were couple boarding schools here in the state of Michigan, and the experts will tell us that some of the historical trauma that deals with that Native people today are faced with depression or what have you has to deal with boarding school experience. And that is really when the government sanctioned schools, government would come take Indian kids out of their homes and send them off to boarding schools, and they would be separated from their parents. And I just have a hard time, and my children are young adults, but I have a hard time fancying how that could have happened and what I would have done, you know, two or three generations ago. I think I would have been fighting. They would have put me in jail. I would have said, no, you're not taking my children, sending them to school, but it is what it is.
And certainly, as you say, the effects are being felt, because it was such an effort to subvert and wipe out Native culture, Native government.
That's very true, and it was the old line was, kill the Indian, save the man. And it was, you know, kill the Indian spirit. And that's why, and going back to what we were talking about, the culture, the idea that there has been a resurgence in my lifetime really makes me feel really happy. And it is that we can celebrate who we are as Native people. And it really is a situation. Obviously, and here we are in 2016, we have to obviously coexist. But at the same time, why not celebrate who we are as do the Dutch people where I live on the west side of the state, you know, with the Holland Tulip Festival every May. I mean, hey, I love it when they celebrate, and they get, you know, they dress in their attire, the wooden shoes, and clean the streets. Well, that's a wonderful thing, because they are celebrating who they are as Dutch people. And likewise, when Native people are out at powwows dancing, not to de-emphasize it, but I say the leathers and feathers, when they put on the regalia and dance, it's just a beautiful thing. And there's a gentleman who lives here in the Grand Rapids area told me that he had served in Vietnam, and when he came home, he had not felt very welcome. And that was that era back then, you know, the anti-war. He said, but he went to a powwow, got invited into the circle, and he said for the first time since he returned from Vietnam, this is a Caucasian gentleman, he said, he had tears in his eyes, and they just flowed because they were honoring what his service to the country. He had never felt that before until he went to Indian powwow. So, you know, I tell that story because I think it's pretty significant to the point where a lot of times healing can take place at powwow. So I think that's a beautiful thing.
And really the message of Our Fires Still Burn, the Native American Experience, this film is about healing and about rebuilding and looking at what tribes in Michigan are doing. And what do you hope audiences will take away from watching Our Fires Still Burn?
You know, very similar to what you just said. You know, the healing and reconciliation, the idea that Native people, we coexist here in society. Your neighbors could be American Indians. You may not even know it. We want to be able to coexist and celebrate who we are and really educate people that we're not the dirty savages that show up in history books.
Levi Rickert is a producer of Our Fires Still Burn and a journalist and editor with the Native News Online and editor-in-chief of the Tribal Business Journal. Levi is a member of the Prairie Band of the Potawatomi Nation. You can find out more and you can order a DVD by going to the website, OurFiresStillBurn.com. Levi, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Hey, it's my pleasure. And likewise, I always enjoy talking to you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A follow-up to the story we brought you about Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III. He's facing 15 criminal charges related to prostitution in three counties, and that includes a 20-year felony charge for allegedly telling a woman he could help her with financial problems by paying her for sex. Feeling she had little choice, the woman says she began an on-and-off commercial sex relationship with the prosecutor. Dunnings is leaving office next week. Word came today that he has applied for county retirement benefits. It isn't known yet how much he might receive. Dunnings will be replaced by former state lawmaker Gretchen Whitmer until his term's up at year's end. Six candidates are on the November ballot to become the next elected prosecutor for Ingham County. More Syrian refugees have come to Michigan seeking a new life than any other state. The State Department tells us that 505 Syrian refugees settled in Michigan between May 2011 and this past May 31st, and more are on the way. Let's talk about what refugees go through to be allowed to move to the U.S. and Michigan's role in resettling these immigrants. With us now from the State Department is Heather Higginbottom. She's the Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources. Welcome to Stateside, Heather.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The numbers certainly seem to point to the fact that Michigan has a pretty outsized role in resettling refugees. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, Michigan has been a terrific partner of the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program for years and has done a wonderful job of really welcoming refugees into your state and into your communities.
This goes back a ways, and certainly I'm interested in a sense, if you can give us that, of the numbers of refugees that we might expect to come to the country or even to our state in this fiscal year and then maybe looking ahead to the next fiscal year.
We have pledged to admit 85,000 refugees in this fiscal year, at least 10,000 of which are Syrians. And we're working very hard to ensure that all of the candidates that we have prioritized go through the extensive security and vetting procedures and then are identified to be connected with a community somewhere in the United States.
What you just said, it's worth looking into the fact that you're talking about we'll be admitting 85,000 refugees, including 10,000 Syrians. And certainly the Syrian situation takes a lot of attention. But what are some of the other countries refugees are coming from?
We really have refugees all over the world. The world is facing the largest migration crisis since the Second World War. There are 65 million people who have been forcibly displaced from their homes. And we resettle just a very small percentage of that number, but it's really important for people to understand that we prioritize those who are the most vulnerable and in need of opportunity. And that's why we were so pleased to team up with the Ad Council for the release of their new campaign called Welcome Refugees, which is about providing information to the American public and also providing opportunities for them to get involved.
And a lot of that has to be about quelling fears.
Well, certainly their new website, embracerefugees.org, will contain a lot of information for people who want to get educated about the program. We resettle very vulnerable refugees. In fact, over the last 10 years, 60% of the refugees resettled in the United States are women and children. There's also an extensive process of security screening and vetting that takes place. It involves multiple federal agencies, from the National Counterterrorism Center to the FBI Terrorist Screening Center and Departments of Homeland Security, State, and Defense. And not until all of those checks are complete and cleared may a refugee actually travel to the United States.
And let's talk more about the vetting process and what it looks like, because certainly in Michigan, our Governor Snyder has been very open to welcoming refugees to the state. But after the attacks last November in Paris, he talked about wanting to suspend resettlement until any concerns about the vetting process are addressed. And of course, I know we realize states don't determine who gets in and how many refugees we get. But with that in mind, I'd still like to get a better sense in talking with you about the vetting process. What is that process like?
Well, that's why this campaign is so important, so that we can ask questions that people have. it starts out with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees identifying those very vulnerable refugees who may be candidates for resettlement in the United States. And then they undergo several interviews, background checks from multiple agencies, and additional checks along the way. That whole process can take a year or even longer because it's so extensive. There are also medical checks that are involved before anyone can travel to the United States. All of those checks must be satisfied. So it's actually quite extensive, and we really appreciate the opportunity to partner with the Ad Council on this campaign because it does answer, provide information to answer the questions that, many people have, and we really embrace the opportunity to embrace refugees.
We are following here on Stateside a Syrian family who went through Jordan before being resettled in Dearborn, and they told us it took 1 year and 7 months to go through the vetting process with multiple long bus trips to meet and be screened and have meetings. Is that typical?
It is typical. It's important that we go through every single step of the process. At the same time, we want to make the process as efficient as possible because we understand that the scope and scale of the migration crisis is such that we need to do more. And the United States is stepping up. We are admitting more refugees. But we have to make sure we follow every single piece of the process as we have been doing for years.
What do you say? And I'm sure in the course of just your life as you go through and you meet people and they learn what you do, what do you say to the people who are worried that allowing refugees, especially from Syria, to settle here can expose us to attacks by terrorists who are posing as refugees?
What I find is when that you have the opportunity to explain how the process works and who is coming to this country, that it answers a lot of the questions that people may have. When I talk about the long tradition and heritage we have in this country of welcoming refugees, that it's a part of who we are, that it makes us safer, not less secure, that when you have that, when you have that conversation, when you can point to the facts, it really answers questions that people may have in their minds. And I find that in my day-to-day work, and I think people are going to find it as part of the Ad Council's campaign as well, when they have the opportunity to go on this website, embracerefugees.org, and get answers to the questions that they may have. And hopefully, they will then also want to become a part of welcoming refugees, just as the state of Michigan has done for years and years.
I'm speaking with Heather Higginbottom of the State Department. She's the Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources. Heather, as these refugees settle into their new lives here in America, here in Michigan, what steps and what resources are in place to assist them, first at your level, at the federal level?
So we work with a network of organizations across the country that are really the first stop to identifying where a refugee or a refugee family will be resettled. And then that initial network has many, many local organizations, so 350 local community-based organizations all around the country exist to support that refugee and their family when they arrive. That could be from donating furniture or clothing to helping a refugee family find a place to live or enroll their children in school. So it's really a very grassroots organization that's there to help refugees become a part of the community. We have a long tradition in this country of refugees coming here and making it a stronger country. And you see when you work with these local organizations just how that happens.
And what responsibility does the refugee have?
So just 3 months after they arrive in this country, there is an expectation and an obligation on the part of the refugee to be self-sufficient. And one of the very first things they have to do is actually pay back the plane ticket that they came to this country on. So we have to make sure through these local organizations and depending on volunteers and a very grassroots model that people are able to be self-sufficient, to find work, to be gainfully employed. And that's been a long tradition in this country.
In the national discourse over resettling refugees in this country and in our state, what things do you hear that just makes you shake your head and go, no, that's not the way things are? I mean, what are the main misconceptions that you really want to take this chance to clear up?
I think one of the most important is that an understanding of who we bring to this country. So when you look at the refugee population globally, it's very large. There's 20 million refugees. When you look at the number that we bring to the United States, and we're the largest resettlement program in the whole world, and we're talking about 85,000, people. And that 85,000 is made up of the most vulnerable refugees, so women and children. I met with a Somali family recently that was about to be resettled to the United States. It was a woman and her 5 children. She had been terribly abused, and her husband had been killed. And all she wanted was to come to this country and have a future for her kids and for herself. And she couldn't wait to get here to start working and giving back. And she was so grateful to the United States for giving her that opportunity.
What would you say are the biggest challenges the State Department faces in finding new homes and resettling refugees?
You know, it's been our experience, actually, that we have a really rich tradition of communities and states that embrace refugees, and we're building on that. And what we're doing with this campaign, with the Ad Council, is ensuring that we're bringing even more people into this process, given the large-scale migration crisis that we're seeing and our desire to continue to grow this program. So I wouldn't characterize them as challenges. I think we've had a really positive response over the years, and now we just need to grow it. And part of doing that is ensuring people have the information that they need to know about the program and then ways in which they can get engaged in their communities.
Why does America need to keep the doors open, do you think? How does doing this make us a safer country?
Well, it's certainly a part of our heritage and our history. President Obama has talked about the openness and opportunity that America provides, and the fact is that does make us stronger, because when people around the world look at this country, they see freedom and opportunity, and they aspire to be like us, to be like this country, and the refugee admissions program is one part of that. The contributions that refugees make in their communities are also really important. We have got cities like Buffalo, New York, and Lewiston, Maine, which are actually looking to the refugee and immigrant populations to revitalize their cities and communities, because they know that these populations will give back. They know that they want to integrate into the communities, and they see it as the future.
And that's certainly been part of the conversation in Michigan. Our governor talked about that, with the city of Detroit. But it must be hard for you, for the State Department, for the agencies that work with these refugees, to overcome the kinds of images we saw, say, let's talk about last November in Paris.
Well, that's why it's so important to get the facts out. And that's why we were so pleased to work with the Ad Council on this, because their website, embracerefugees.org, will provide information so people understand who we are bringing to this country and the steps, the lengthy and thorough process it takes to come here. The fact is that refugees are the most thoroughly screened of any travelers to the United States. And these are facts and parts of the process that we want to make sure more people are aware of.
Heather Higginbottom is with the State Department. She's the Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources. Heather, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Among the Syrians who fled their homeland for Michigan is a young family of 5. They came here just this past April, trading the violence and death of their Syrian city of Homs for a sparsely furnished rented corner duplex in a modest neighborhood in Dearborn. We'll be bringing you the story of this young family over the next months as they settle into their new life in Michigan. Mon is a 39-year-old carpenter. His 30-year-old wife, Bayan, was a teacher before the revolution broke out in 2012. Homs has seen some pretty intense fighting throughout the 4-plus years of civil war there. And that danger forced Mon and Bayan to make a painful decision. First, they fled to Jordan, where they stayed with relatives. And after a vetting process Mon says took 1 year and 7 months, the family learned earlier this year they were coming to America. And now they're here. Mon, Bayan, and their children, 2 daughters ages 6 and 18 months, and a 4-year-old son, starting over in Michigan. Last month, producer Joe Lindstroth and I visited the family in their Dearborn home. They speak very little English, and they've asked us not to use their last name because they fear media attention could mean bad things for family members still in Syria. But with the help of translators, we all sat together at their 3-and-a-half-legged dining room table, and we talked, sharing biscuits and strong cardamom-scented coffee. And it turns out that's all you need. For nearly 1.5 hours, we talked about all sorts of things. Let's start with first impressions. Apprehensions can run in both directions. Here's Bayan.
I was a little worried when we were told that we would be coming to the United States because of what I've been seeing on the news. And I still get, you know, inquiries by my friends. How is it for you there? Like, how are people treating you? You know, you wear a headscarf. Has that affected the way people are treating you? And I would say, no, actually, everybody's been so nice and accepting, and I haven't had any issues at all. When I was coming to the United States en route, we stopped in Ukraine. And in Ukraine, I felt those kinds of looks and the kinds of things that people were asking me about. But over here, it's a country of freedom, freedom of religion. It's just got so much freedom, and I'm lucky to be here.
The first day I got here, I was a little skeptical. The doors are not as thick here as they are back home. I saw a couple instances outside. People were arguing. 911 was called. Immediately, 2 minutes later, they were here. After we saw things like that, we felt a little safe and started leaving our windows open, because we know that if we call for help, it is going to come.
The kids, on the other hand, were not so apprehensive.
The second day, you know, we woke up, we went out, explored the street, explored the front yard. The kids were very happy. We took pictures of the kids, we took pictures of us, and we sent them to our family back home.
We drank more coffee and talked as the three children played around us. Just a few weeks into their new life in Michigan, free from the risk of shells crashing through the ceiling or government troops arresting them, it's clear Man and Bayan are once again allowing themselves to dream.
My number one priority is my children, making sure they get their education, making sure they have a bright future ahead of them, making sure they're happy and healthy. Secondary is, you know, finding work that I'm happy with, work that I'll be successful in. And tertiary to that, finding a house that I can call mine.
Yes, we are refugees, and you maybe have a fear of us because you don't know us, just as we have a fear when we arrived here because we didn't know what to expect. But as time goes on, you will get to know us, and you will see that we are going to be friends. We are brothers and sisters. We are people who help each other out. We are just all human beings. There's no separation or ill will towards other people or other religions.
That was Bayan and Man from Homs, Syria. The couple arrived in Dearborn in April with their three young children. We'll check in with this family periodically on Stateside as they settle in and start the Michigan chapter of their lives. In the coming weeks, we'll learn what life was like at home in Syria before the Civil War, how things changed once war broke out, their journey to Michigan, and why they hope to shed that label of refugees. A special thanks to the Syrian American Rescue Network and to Reem Akkad and Samer Kujan for help with translation. And that's our program. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.